I'm sorry to differ with you, sir. But you are the caretaker. You've always been the caretaker.
Welcome to The Shining 237, the podcast where we look at Stanley Kubrick's horror masterpiece, The Shining, in 2 minute and 37 second bloody chunks. Today we are on episode number 34. The segment we are looking at begins with Delbert Grady saying to Jack, "Why no, sir, I don't believe so." And we end with Grady saying, "Did you know, Mr. Torrance, that your son is attempting..." And the rest of the sentence will be next week. Let me introduce my guests, and then we'll talk about this, which is my favorite segment of the entire movie. So, I'm very happy to have a spectacular guest for this episode.
Oh, thank
which
you.
Is my good friend and ex-colleague, science writer Corey Powell. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
You've actually been on my bonus episodes. You did my 2001 roundtable, and you did my Doctor Strangelove roundtable.
Right. This is a whole other ball of wax over here, as they say.
Oh, absolutely. But you were amazing on those, so thank you. And Corey is a consulting editor at American Scientist. He is a editor at large at Discover Magazine. We used to work together at Discover. He used to be the editor-in-chief, and I worked there as a loyal reporter editor.
You were awesome, by the way.
Thank you. And he also does a lot of writing for Bill Nye, both in books and TV. And sometimes you even see him as a talking head talking about science.
Yes.
And Corey, normally we would probably be meeting up because he lives in Brooklyn. I don't usually talk about like what day it is because podcasts are supposed to be kind of timeless. But we're recording this on the actual 4th of July. So first of all, thank you for being available on a holiday. I really appreciate that.
It's my daughter's birthday today.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
So you monster, you've taken me away from family obligations, but it's okay. It's okay. I'm happy to be here.
I now remember that because I worked with you when your daughter was born, and it was and we had Alan Burdick was the other editor, and his twins were born on the same exact day.
Yes, Alan Burdick then went on to The New Yorker, and now is working on books.
Yes, that's amazing. Happy birthday, Eliza.
I will pass that along. Thank you.
Oh my God, how old is she?
She just turned 12, and she keeps running around saying something about red rum. I don't know what that means.
No. So Corey is a family man. He's a grown-up, unlike me, and he's out in the Poconos.
The Poconos.
For the 4th of July. Now, anybody from the New York tri-state area, the Poconos has a certain sentimentality about it because we grew up listening to the commercials for Poconos vacations. You know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about.
So we're going to have to, I'm afraid, sprinkle Poconos commercials throughout this episode because so many listeners are from the New York area. If you're not from the New York area, you've probably have your own version of these Poconos commercials for whatever romantic 70s lodges existed. This is for Gen Xers especially. So are you at Mount Airy Lodge? Any chance?
I'm not even in a lodge. I'm in a rambling family home, like an Airbnb type home. So it's not, unfortunately, it does not correspond to your picture, but there is still a place out here where you can get the honeymoon suite and it has a champagne glass shaped bathtub. So some of that still exists.
Yes, champagne glass. Yes, absolutely.
Now is the perfect time. Any season is just right. You can play all day and dance into the night.
At beautiful Mount Airy Lodge, all you have to bring is your love.
And we will get back to the Poconos because there's so many great commercials as we go along in this episode. Okay, so what one of the things we are going to do is at the end of the show, we're going to talk a little bit about science versus the paranormal, just a little bit since Corey is Mr. Science Expert. So stay tuned for that. Okay, so let's just jump into this episode as if it were a heart-shaped hot tub.
It could be the heart-shaped bed and the champagne glass swimming pool. That's how I'm picturing this episode.
Let me say, if you look on YouTube, someone actually filmed one of those rooms with the champagne glasses he filmed it on his iPhone or whatever, and he goes through the whole hotel room, and it's really interesting. So everybody look, I'll put that up on my Shining 237 website, the Shining237.com. Okay, so we are in, I've said this a million times, everybody's sick of me saying this, but this is my favorite scene, and this is the segment of the entire scene. This is the best part. So in my opinion.
I love the feeling of a slow build story where the sort of the layers of reality keep getting peeled away, and there's certainly an abundance of that in The Shining.
Yeah, and again, this scene in particular, you know, is like to me the ultimate of setting the standard of, you know, they call it slow burn now, but I mean this scene in itself is so slow. It makes it perfect. So we're going to read, I'm going to actually talk a little bit about how they put the scene together. Let me read from the script a little bit, and we're going to just take the listeners through the, you know, 2 minutes and 37 seconds of the scene. So we have Jack has come out from the gold room. It had some avocat spilled on him. Last week, I actually made avocat and tasted it and on my own stovetop.
And how is it? Because I've never had it.
It's so good. And I'm so not an alcohol drinker. It tastes like brandy frosting. Like if you were going to frost a cake with brandy, that's what it tastes like. It's so good. It's sugar. It's brandy and sugar and some egg yolk and a little vanilla and a touch of salt. And that's it. And then you do it on a double boiler. And I mean, really, it is like decadent as hell. So yeah, avocado. It's good stuff. No avocados. In avocado. Okay, so Grady is now cleaning the avocado off of Jack very delicately. He's got his little white towel as if Jack is some kind of, you know, China doll, you know, like he's fragile. It's sort of funny the way he's doing it. So Jack has just asked him, aren't you Delbert Grady? And he said, yes. Haven't I seen you somewhere before? And he says, well, no, sir, I don't believe so. It's coming off now, sir. And Jack says, Mr. Grady, weren't you once the caretaker here? Why, no, sir, I don't believe so. And then he starts cleaning Jack's trousers, which is so kind of uncomfortable. Isn't it?
the whole scene, that's the unctuous servitude of it is part of what makes it so deeply unsettling.
Yes. And just before this scene, Jack was just being a jackass to these ghosts. Like he was giving Lloyd, you know, he was being sort of very flippant to Lloyd.
It's and like, then, I want to know who's paying for my drinks and all that.
Right, yeah. Right. And then with Grady, he called him Jeevesy 3 times. I mean, you know, how obnoxious, you know, this guy would have been thrown out of this party, you know, the second he walked in. But so it's so funny, the contrast between him calling Grady Jeevesy and being such an ass and Grady just delicately serving him with his little, like his body kind of hunched over and his arm bent and, you know, treating Jack like he's a delicate, you know, little thing. And like I said, when he goes for the trousers, it's like, whoa. And you're in this men's room with no doors on any of the stalls. Did you notice in the back, the toilets have no doors on the booths?
I didn't, but now that you say it, yes, you're absolutely right.
So, first of all, you know, if this was a real party of this size, there would be other people in there, you know, obviously, right?
Right. And harkening back to when we were talking about 2001, this to me is probably one of the most 2001 scenes of the entire movie that, you know, where all of a sudden you're in this strange, empty, kind of sterile environment that just happens to be an opulent bathroom.
Yes. Yes, I actually said that last week. It's so funny. The look of the scene could be easily spliced into 2001, especially the monochrome, you know, just having two colors, because so many scenes in 2001 is just two colors, you know, like that wonderful, the flight attendant walking through the upside down, you know, in a circle. It's just that pale mustard and white, you know, or, you know, there's just so many scenes that have these great two, you know, white and color. So this could easily be spliced into that. So, you know, you wouldn't even notice the difference.
Yeah, it could definitely be the bathroom from the closing scene of 2001 where, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in the room with the monolith. He says, oh, excuse me, I need to go to the restroom for a second. And this is the restroom.
Right, exactly. So Grady's patting on his jeans with a towel and he says, You're a married man, are you, Mr. Grady? Grady says, yes, sir. I have a wife and two daughters, sir. And Jack says, and where are they now? And Jack has this look on his face where he looks mischievous. He looks like he knows this big secret and he's so excited about it, like some little kid, which is weird, right? Because, you know, he realizes this is a murderer. He had heard the story of Grady from Ullman at the beginning of the movie, that this guy hacked his children to death with an axe. And as we'll see, you know, he also saw it in the scrapbook, which were scenes that were cut out of this movie. But he kind of refers to that. So why is he's just so jacked up, excuse the pun, to be like, have this secret of knowing who this is.
One thing that is very striking about this scene, and I'm sure it's come up in the other scenes because it's striking throughout the movie, which is how much of the acting in this movie is done by Jack Nicholson's eyebrows.
Oh, yes.
They're one of the most legendary pairs of eyebrows in all of cinema. But I feel like in this movie in particular, they're doing so much of that kind of like that impish role playing, just watching what he's doing there.
The eyebrows are doing the heavy lifting. He's just this guy attached to these eyebrows. Yeah, no, we've talked about that. They're like their own character in this movie. And he was born with them. That's the way they are. And actually, interestingly, Stanley Kubrick had similar kind of eyebrows.
I did notice that.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
They're right up there with the kind of like, you know, with like Spock and Groucho and these sort of like these iconic cinema eyebrows.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he says, they're somewhere around. I'm not quite sure at the moment. And then Jack just grabs that white towel and just wipes his hands with it and then tosses it in the sink. And he says, Mr. Grady, you were the caretaker here. I recognize you. I saw your picture in the newspapers. You chopped up your wife and daughters up into little bits and you blew your brains out. Now, your daughter's not listening to this, right?
She is not. No.
Okay. Just.
I've got headphones on. I'm in the basement. It's
just checking. Happy birthday, Eliza.
Exactly. Okay. Yes.
So yes.
I am a married man.
And you're up in a remote location.
I'm in a remote location with my two little girls.
With your two little girls. He has two little girls and his wife. I imagine there's reasons to have an axe in the Poconos. I'm not going to ask about that, but, you know, I know you probably have a fireplace. But no, Corey's cool. I know Corey. This is fine. They're safe. But let's just ponder back to a time when there was a jingle that went 226-0841.
226-0841, the Pocono Gardens Lodge.
That's your honeymoon hotline at Pocono Gardens Lodge, paradise for honeymoon lovers. Ski, play tennis, swim, have a ball. Winter, spring, summer, fall. For reservations, call
226-0841, the Pocono Gardens Lodge.
That was my favorite. That was my personal favorite. Are you like near any of these romantic locations?
I'm in a weird castle-like house at the end of a cul-de-sac, at the bottom of a hill in this not quite gated community, but it's this little like this closed-off area with its own private pool. So I have to admit, in a snooty part of the Poconos.
Do you see young lovers walking around hand in hand?
There's some young lovers. There's some actual legitimate wildlife here too. We've seen we saw wild turkeys, some beavers. We might have seen a fox.
That's awesome.
Although I know from experience, it could also have been like a house cat with a white tail and some of my imagination. But I'm calling it a fox.
Okay, so Jack has now accused Grady of blowing his own brains out after murdering his family. Grady says, that's strange, sir. I don't have any recollection of that at all. And then Jack says, Mr. Grady, you were the caretaker here. And this is the scene. You know, this is like the bunch of lines that gives me chills every time I see it. And Grady says, I'm sorry to differ with you, sir, but you are the caretaker. You have always been the caretaker. I should know, sir. I've always been here. And I'm going to read you a little bit about how they put that scene together, because there's something about this scene that is so different. It is so roomy. There's so much space between the lines. It feels like a nightmare. And it's hard to explain exactly why, but do you feel that way?
Absolutely. And well, I want to hear more of your theory, because you've obviously thought about the scene a lot more deeply than I have. But, you know, I rewatched it, you know, ahead of doing this podcast. And you know, what's so striking is the way Grady slowly builds up to the information that he doesn't deny anything. He doesn't admit anything, but there's just a, right. like a slow drip of sort of increasing ownership of his role and his knowledge and just the total horror of the situation without him ever actually saying it until you get to the very, you know, to that pinnacle moment of saying, you are the caretaker. You've always been the caretaker. And then it's such a, it has such bite to it because it's been such a, like a drip lead up to it.
Yes. And these ghosts, including Lloyd, you know, are so smart, you know, in the way they're so smooth and they're so tricky. They're very tricky. And I always say this over and over, they're playing him like a cat with a mouse, you know. And so they're being very, both Lloyd and Grady, both very subservient, like absolutely subservient to Jack, but are completely controlling him, you know, and also smacking down his kind of insolence, you know, that he's been throwing at them in a way that he doesn't even understand. You know, he doesn't even realize what's happening. And he's just absorbing this like a sponge. Now, in the book, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining Studies in Horror, edited by Dennis Alston, which is a book I refer to so much. It's like, you can't believe it's so beat up. It's a very hard to find book. And it's just one of the absolute best books on The Shining. So there's an interview with Gordon Stainforth, who I've mentioned a bunch of times. He's the one who edited in all the music, which is so much one of the secrets of this movie, of you know, one of the beautiful, you know, one of the absolute best aspects of this movie is how the music, not only the music chosen, but how it was edited into the scenes. He did a lot of the work at the end of the movie, but he assisted during these scenes. So the interviewer says, did you cut together the red bathroom sequence? And he says, well, Stanley was the one who cut that together, and I don't know what it was about it, but he was never, ever happy with it until right at the end. I don't know for sure exactly how many times he recut the scene. Sometimes he'd recut with Gil Smith, which is a female editor he worked with. He'd recut it with Ray Lovejoy, who is like the most famous editor of this, and he'd recut it with me. He'd recut it, and then when you thought it was done to his satisfaction, he'd forget about it for about a week at a time. And then he'd say, Gordon, can you get me out the red bathroom scene? And then Gordon laughs. And he says he'd go through each cut over and over. And typically when he recut it, it would just lengthen each shot. Because the way that Jack and Philip Stone performed the scene was much tighter than how it was cut for the film. Stanley was really playing with the timing of the scene, and when I see it now, I can't believe how good it is. Stanley cut that in a very painstaking way, and it was probably the scene in the film that the most time was spent on. He worked on that scene for weeks and weeks. And, you know, I always say people don't realize how important the editing is. And this just is exactly, you know, the perfect example of what masterful editing can do. And again, I really think this is one of the greatest scenes in any movie. And I can't think of any movie that has a scene that's quite like this.
I want to hear a little bit more about your read on this scene. Is it specifically that use of is it the empty space? Is that why you consider this such a masterful scene? Is it sort of that integration of the kind of like the minimalist aesthetic and the minimalist pacing? What is it that has such a strong effect on you?
To me, it is how it evokes a nightmare feel, and it is because of all the space in it. And it's because they're trapped in this room. And also, you'll notice as they're talking here, at one point, it's like a shot of their upper bodies, you know, while he's sort of patting him, you know, cleaning off the avocat. But when they get to this part with the where they're talking about being the caretaker, it flips completely. So first of all, the two characters flip 180, which isn't done very much in movies. Like, it's a director's rule that you don't flip the characters 180. But of course, Kubrick did it because he didn't care. And then they're sort of further off in the distance. They are, you know, you see their entire bodies with a lot of space around them. And it almost has this Alice in Wonderland feel to it, where suddenly it's like that hallucinogenic effect like, I know when I was a kid and I would get fevers, suddenly size was wonky. Like, things that were large felt small and things that were far felt close. Do you remember? Have you ever had that kind of experience?
I have an interesting experience. I want to let you finish because my experience is a little bit weird and tangential. So finish what you're saying and then I'm going to go off in a slightly different direction.
Yeah. Well, so anyway, to me, it is the combination of the shots he chose as far as the spacing of, you know, visually, and the space between the words, the space between the lines, that makes it like so absorbing. So it's so intense. Like, there's just, for a normal conversation where nobody's shouting, nobody's crying, you know, there's just, it's just absolutely, you know, a normal conversation. It is so intense. Like, it just sucks you in. And it's just, again, a creepy, creepy feeling when you're watching this. And also, you know, like you said, it's the feeling of Grady reeling him in, and the feeling to me of Jack absorbing this poison that Grady is, you know, trying to expose him to, you know, that he's, you know, trying to inject him with.
So you reminded me of something that I hadn't thought about in relation to this movie, but it was the first fever dream that I remember in my life. And I was, who knows, you know, probably 8 or 10 years old, had the flu, had, you know, the sweats and chills and fever, and it was sleeping fitfully under a blanket. And I was having a nightmare. It's a recurring nightmare that I've had since then. And the nightmare is being smothered underneath a giant chicken wing.
Okay.
I don't even see the chicken, but there's this giant chicken wing that's weighing down on me, and I'm completely immobilized. And maybe it's related to that feeling of sleep paralysis. But, you know, as you were describing the scene, as I'm kind of reliving this scene, that's kind of the feeling of this scene also, that there's something oppressive and inescapable, and you don't even see what it's connected to, but you feel it bearing down on you. And so, yeah, I think, you know, I wasn't consciously channeling back to that, my bizarre chicken dream, but it's very much that kind of a feeling.
Yes, yes. That's the thing. I mean, you know, there's some feeling when you're having a nightmare that's hard to explain, and it's so rare for a horror movie to really capture that. And, you know, that's one of the things with this movie, obviously. Nobody gets that really eerie, dreamlike quality that Kubrick got out of this. And of course, he had that in 2001. Like when we discussed in our 2001 roundtable, I believe 2001 laid the groundwork for him being a director who could master horror, you know, because when you look at those last scenes in 2001, both when he's going through the Stargate and when he's in the supposed, you know, hotel room, those are so friggin' scary. It feels very nightmarish. And when even when the pod is murdering Frank, it is just put together in a way that is exactly like a horror movie. And it's creepy. It's horrifying. And then, of course, the Ligeti music, you know, all the elements that he put into The Shining, he had already there in 2001.
Right. And part of what I enjoy so much about 2001, especially in the movie more than in the book, is the sense that the alien monolith, whatever it is, yes, it's been directing humanity, but you don't really know that it's been directing humanity for a good end. You don't really know what its agenda is. And so in that sense, you know those final sequences, you really don't know, like, is this like a bold new future for humanity, or basically has it come to kill us all in its own its own weird roundabout way? There is a sort of an undercurrent of horror in there. And it's interesting, in the later sequels to 2001 that Arthur C. Clarke wrote, which are in many ways terrible books, but what's interesting about them is that he kind of increasingly turned the monolith into a villain, and, you know, into this sort of like this enemy that humanity has to overcome. And I totally think that was Clarke channeling Kubrick rather than Clarke staying true to the way he had originally conceived the story.
Yeah, that's interesting. Definitely. So we've basically ended the scene, because then the next line is already, "Did you know, Mr. Torrance, that your son is attempting to bring an outside party. And that's where we go into the next scene. Now, let me also just quickly mention that when Jack says, I saw your picture in the newspapers, again, that's because there were scenes filmed where Jack was looking through this scrapbook of the hotel. Kubrick decided not to use them, so they were incinerated. But so it's just interesting that they kept, you know, that line is a little bit confusing now because he took out those scenes. They don't quite make sense. I saw your picture in the newspapers. You know, you wouldn't know why he possibly would have seen Grady's picture. Anyway, next week I have Adam Howard, who is a associate producer at the Samantha Bee Full Frontal show, which is one of my favorite shows in the whole world. And he's a really funny, wonderful cinephile who will be talking about, actually, we're going to talk a little bit about the N-word because that comes up next week. The scene continues and gets even more disturbing, actually, because of the use of that word. And we're going to talk about that. So let's talk a little bit, since you're a science guy, about the Poconos. Let's see. Wait, there's one that was like Penn Hills for Lovers Only. Wait, it was this really irritatingly sweet song.
Tennis, water sports, romantic dining and dancing, and your own private villa. You'll love Penn Hills in the nearby Poconos.
If you're in love, you'll love Penn Hills.
Call toll-free 800-233-8130 for reservations at Penn Hills.
For lovers only.
Do you remember that one?
No, so you have to understand, I grew up outside Washington, D.C., so I came to these, you know, I know these from clips and from people referring to them.
So did you have like weird vacation spots that had cheesy commercials? Because
Rehoboth Beach and Bethany Beach were probably, you know, those were the kind of like the big those are the big destinations for people heading toward the water from Washington D.C.
Come on down and treat your family to the best of summer. Sand, surf, sun, and fun. It's all waiting for you. Capture an ocean memory in Ocean City, Maryland.
Ocean City, here we come.
We just had the best jingles. That's what people did in New York City. You became a jingle writer. That was the New York dream. We all wanted to be jingle writers. All right. So let's talk a little bit about science and the paranormal. So this movie is mostly about ghosts, obviously, and also it's about psychicness. Danny has a psychic ability. You know, I thought it'd be interesting to talk a little bit about the science of the paranormal, what is confusing about it, what is real, what isn't, what people have looked at. Now, Kubrick himself did believe in ESP. He believed that that was real. He felt he saw his cats having it, and he felt that there would be a time, he said, when we would crack that, like where the scientists would be understanding that, or, you know, establishing it more clearly. And of course that never happened. But when, during this time in the 70s and 80s, there were actual research institutions on some pretty impressive campuses looking at this stuff. One of them was at Princeton University, the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab, PAIR, as they affectionately called it. It no longer exists, but it existed till friggin' 2007, and they mostly looked at psychic ability. Do you remember anything about that?
The one that I remember more is John Lilly and the experiments, you know, talking to dolphins and trying to understand, you know, cross species communication.
Yes.
I don't remember as much about PAIR, but, you know, part of what's really interesting about that time, and it's, you know, it's sort of hard to remember now, people's mindsets were a lot more flexible back then. You know, I mean, Carl Sagan was a big fan of John Lilly. You know, John Lilly, yeah, you know, these days, if he's remembered at all, he's remembered as this guy who was sort of out there with the, you know, the LSD freaks and, you know, weird paranormalists as this strange fringe character. But here's Carl Sagan, who was like the premier super serious science popularizer of the time, probably, you know, one of the great science popularizers of the 20th century. And he was not only fascinated by these experiments, you know, he took them seriously. He talked about them on, you know, on the Tonight Show and places like that. and you ended up with movies like Day of the Dolphin. You know, these ideas that kind of cross over into pop culture. So, I mean, the Shining is coming along right around the same time as the Cosmos TV show, and mining these ideas that were not as fringe as I think we commonly perceive them today.
Yes, I don't think young people would really realize that. It's hard to know about that, but it was, you know, when I was in high school, I took, I've talked about this before, but I took a psychology class when I was a senior, and the psychology teacher had us test our ESP. She totally believed in it. And that was part of our class. You know, it was good high school. It wasn't weirdos. It was good. I had very good teachers. And, you know, I was taught about ESP as a very serious thing. So it's hard to imagine it now, but the 70s were a weird time, or the 80s. It was in the 80s that I went to high school. Just another research lab, which is still in existence, is the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia. And actually, I remember you guys at Discover Magazine sending me there. yes. You sent me there. And I think I was doing research for some other writer. Like, I wasn't doing the article myself, but you sent me to, like, get quotes and stuff and some color to see what it looked like and all that stuff. And, you know, it was just your basic little university department with books everywhere. But, I mean, it was just, like, folder after folder after folder after folder of reincarnation stories. So they actually, their main interest was reincarnation. The person who started that lab was Ian Stevenson, who is now dead. He believed in reincarnation, and that's their main focus there. And this still exists on the University of Virginia, which is interesting because a lot of bad stuff goes down at the University of Virginia. Have they opened a door to the dark side? I don't know. But University of Virginia, like every year, there's some horrifying story. Let alone that they had a massacre, you know, one of the most severe massacres there. A lot of shit goes down at the University of Virginia.
So, you know, back at Discover Magazine, where we both worked, there was a period where Discover Magazine was run by CEO Bob Guccione Jr. Bob Guccione Jr.'s father, Bob Sr., people know him as the founder and creator of Penthouse, right. But he was also the founder and creator of Omni Magazine. Which, of course, was one of the great kind of popularizers and communicators of a lot of these, you know, sort of psychic and paranormal research ideas. So
mixing it with real science, right?
Mixing it with real science, yeah, and taking it, you know, trying to take it seriously. So, you know, during those 2 or 3 years when Bob Guccione Jr. was the CEO of the magazine, he was channeling. Even though by now this was like, you know, 2006, 2007, he was channeling a lot of the spirit of the 70s and the early 80s into the magazine. And so we did an article investigating the 21 grams claim, the idea that when people die, their soul leaves the body, that their weight decreases by 21 grams.
Oh, that's right.
That is the weight of the soul. We actually did a piece investigating that.
Oh, my God. I remember I would go into your office and we'd be like, how do we stop this from happening? Like, you know, so many times. And God bless Bob Guccione Jr. Like, I'm not putting him down. I actually got along fine with him. And he's a very smart guy. He's the one who launched Spin Magazine, which is an amazing magazine. But he always had fringe science ideas that we as really science-oriented people would be like, how do we block this? How do we make this not happen? And I remember I did an interview with Suzanne Summers, who had sort of a crackpot thing about hormones. And I did an interview with someone who I won't name, who believed HIV and AIDS is a myth. And I actually got a lot of criticism for even doing that interview, you know, from peers. So,
well,
yeah, those.
Yeah, but that was, you know, it was nerve wracking, but it was also kind of fascinating to go back and reopen these stories and try to do, you know, a fair, open-minded assessment of what is total BS and what's interesting and what is just stuff that nobody ever even really looked into because it's so far out there. I think, you know, I ended up doing an interview with Rupert Sheldrake. He believes, I wouldn't say he believes in biomorphic fields, but he thinks that there may be things called biomorphic fields that are responsible for ESP and for other kinds of connections. And he specifically was investigating the phenomenon, does your dog really know that you're coming home before you get home? And he's like, it's like people say this all the time that, you know, like they're at home with the dog and like, you know, the dog's owner went off on a trip. And when the owner is like 10 miles away, you know, way outside of hearing range, the dog suddenly, you know, perks up and realizes that, my owner is back, is coming home. My owner is coming home. He's like, okay, well, maybe that exists. Maybe it doesn't. But people report it all the time. Shouldn't we at least investigate it and see if it's true? And I have to admit, you know, I went into the interview very dubious. And I came out of the interview thinking, you know, it's perfectly reasonable. You know, if you could actually design a scientific methodology for something that people report anecdotally all the time, and it's probably not true, but if there's any truth to it, it would be revolutionary. Why not look? And, you know, that did, I think, you know, kind of wipe away a certain amount of just kind of like reflexive naysaying that I had before I spoke to him.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about, there are, I've come across now at this point recently, scientists who do believe in a few weird things, and wanted to talk with you a little bit about it, because by coincidence, I did an article recently for Slate about a murder trial, and it's basically about psychiatry, the field of psychiatry. And I interviewed the chair of psychiatry at Columbia, and he also runs the New York State Psychiatric Institute. This is as big as it gets. Like, he is just about the top guy in psychiatry. He's quoted all the time. He's written books. But I've been sort of looking into, William Friedkin recently put out a movie, an article in Vanity Fair, and then a movie, a documentary that's out called The Devil and Father Amorth, because Friedkin really does believe in possession. And so this priest, Gabriel Amorth, who died a few years ago, was one of the big exorcists in Italy. You know, he did thousands of exorcisms. And there are increasingly more priests who do this because the demand is rising. I think 500,000 people in Italy every year ask for an exorcism or something like that. It's really amazing. So in this documentary and in articles I'm reading, Lieberman and some of the other people at Columbia University are saying they have seen things they can't explain. Jeffrey Lieberman is the person I'm talking about. He had actually studied a patient who claimed to be possessed and tried to treat her for several months. He said after sessions with the woman, he'd go home in the evenings, I'm reading this from an article, and the lights in his house would go off by themselves, photographs and artwork would fall or slide off shelves, and he'd experience a piercing headache. When he mentioned this to one of his colleagues, her response stunned him. She'd been having the same experiences. And I saw some other article or source, he had seen like blue lights, and she had also seen blue lights. And so, you know, people are, and then there's another Columbia psychiatrist. Oh, Columbia. Richard Gallagher.
Oh, yes. I was wondering if we were going to get to Richard Gallagher.
Right. So Richard Gallagher actually accompanies exorcists on their exorcisms. And he actually wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post about how he has witnessed what he believes are absolutely 100% legit exorcisms. So he is, you know, again, he's teaching classes at Columbia. He's charging people $300 an hour for his psychiatric services, I'm sure, because that's what these people charge. And he is a man who completely 100% believes in possession. So what do you think of that? You know, that just, when I saw that Lieberman, who I had interviewed and read his books, and he's such a fabulous scientist, when I read this, it really gave me incredible pause. You know, it was shocking, absolutely shocking to me. And he's Jewish, by the way, you know.
So, you know, I have, you know, my brain kind of splits into two types of opinions of these things. One is, you know, I try to hold on to the lesson I was just describing of when I was talking to Rupert Sheldrake. You know, I try to maintain an open mind about these things. On the other hand, I also know that intelligent, competent people, when they're confronted with things that they don't understand, they themselves kind of lose the ability to maintain an open possibility of the limits of their own knowledge. And I think that, you know, it's very tempting, if you have this huge reputation and a high estimate of your own knowledge and scientific capability, that when you see something that you don't understand, you try to map it into something else. Something else that you already know about, or something else that makes sense to you, rather than leaving it in that bin of, here's something that needs genuine investigation because it shows the area where I'm stupid, or it shows the area where human intellect and human knowledge just has not, you know, has not gone there yet. And so I sort of take these things with a grain of salt that you know, the idea that, you know, people with expertise embrace these peculiar phenomena sort of the same way that John Mack at Harvard, embraced alien abduction. I think in some cases we may be seeing really, you know, kind of professional hubris as much as anything that still could be the human mind imposing, a very kind of conservative framework onto something where the real answer is there are human behaviors and there are, you know, human psychoses that we just don't understand.
Yeah. You know, the brain can do amazing things. You know, I personally, in my life, first of all, I have hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations, which are when you're just falling asleep or you're just waking up, you have hallucinations. And I always, all my life, had voice hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, where I'd hear people saying my name or, or just saying something. That was really scary because that's exactly what it is. And or they'll say, you know, one word really quickly. And I honest to God recently heard Jack Torrance's voice say my name. Swear to God, that's how much this podcast has seeped into my subconscious. Now, interestingly, lately, I'm also getting some visual hallucinations. I never had that before. It just started like within this last year. And I don't know, again, if it's up because I'm immersing myself in horror movies and seeing, you know, kind of watching a lot more just because I'm doing this podcast. But I'm seeing, as I'm waking up especially, flashes of these horrifying faces. I mean, and it's so clear that I can draw them, you know, and it's not anything from any source. It's like completely made up from my brain. But they're so clear and they're so terrifying. And it's not fun. It is not fun, by the way.
well, no, I think that, you know, those things, you know, they show you sort of what a thin veneer, perceived reality is to us. And, you know, that is, again, you know, that's part of what makes this movie so horrifying is the realization that you think of yourself as this rational being, that what you see and what you hear 100% one-to-one corresponds to reality, and there's no possibility of being deceived. And of course, that's not true. And, you know, it's very unnerving when something that you perceive as real reminds you that, no, you can't really trust those perceptions perfectly.
Yeah. Let me throw in one more, though, from my own experience that I've never solved, which is when I was around 11 years old, I had the feeling of a presence in the room with me all the time for like at least 6 months. It seems to me the memory was like it was for like 9 months. And I was completely aware that this was impossible. It wasn't a hallucination, because generally when you have a hallucination or delusion, you believe it. You know, that's part of the experience, except for a few rare occasions, like if you have macular degeneration, you might see things, or, you know, if you have a fever, you might be aware that, oh, I'm hallucinating right now. But in general, you know, obviously, and let me say, I've worked in mental health, like I know a lot about this stuff. And, you know, generally, it's pretty weird to have what I had. I really haven't really found it much like it in the literature, where I felt this presence and it was absolutely terrible. I mean, it creeped me out. It just felt like someone, it was in the room with me all times, for months. And yet I was aware that that was impossible, that it wasn't like, I knew it wasn't, it couldn't be true. And now I have read that people who are isolated, like Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh, when he flew across the Atlantic, or people who climb Mount Everest, they'll have that kind of hallucination where they feel like a presence is with them. And that's something you get when you're in a large space, like where there's vast space all around you and you're alone and that kind of thing. You will get that feeling of a presence and you'll be aware like this is impossible, you know. So it's interesting. Again, I honestly had that experience and it's like I've never been able to explain it. It could easily be explained by a demonic presence or a ghost, obviously. I mean, that would be the easiest explanation for it. And I actually grew up with grandmothers who swore up and down that they had experiences with ghosts. I mean, we would hear these stories at Thanksgiving and Christmas over and over again about all these amazing ghost stories. My grandmother found money because a ghost gave her the sound of digging and there was some money hidden in the basement. Stuff like, you know, like, it, you know, it's like, these were my grandmothers. I'm, and I, of course, I grew up Catholic too. So there, I was raised to believe in a supernatural element, which I have grown out of and I don't believe in anymore. But I absolutely, when I was a kid and, like, you know, The Exorcist came out, I thought I could be possessed by the devil, which probably obviously could have influenced that experience I had.
Yeah, to me, coming at this from a pretty hard science perspective, I know on the one hand, human beings are capable of all kinds of delusions, of misperceptions and self-deceptions. On the other hand, I also know that scientific investigation has over the years ignored many, many things that people perceive and observe and told them, oh, that's nothing. Oh, that's your mind playing tricks on you, and overlooked real phenomena. And so, I'm always trying to kind of thread that needle. You don't want to close your mind, but you also have to be aware of just like the insane personal subjectivity that makes it really, really hard to look at these things in a clear way.
Well, let's sort of conclude it with, I'm going to quote to you, this is about the Large Hadron Collider. There was some panel discussion, included Neil deGrasse Tyson, our favorite New Yorker, and Brian Cox from the University of Manchester. And they were kind of talking about paranormal experience. And so Brian Cox works with the Large Hadron Collider. Explain briefly to the audience what that is.
Okay. The idea in physics is that basically if you smash small things together and break them into smaller things, you get kind of deeper and deeper toward the ultimate layers of reality. And so that's why you have atom smashers and particle colliders. So Large Hadron Collider is the biggest particle collider ever. It takes protons and their antimatter equivalent, antiprotons, smashes them together at almost the speed of light. And basically it's just like, it's as if you were crashing two cars together head on. You look at all the parts that come off. And then from that, you're like, okay, now let's figure out what a car is made of. It's the right physics equivalent of that.
Right. So of course, when they discovered atoms, that was like, what the hell? Radioactivity, this is all stuff that could have caused phenomena. Obviously, radioactivity in particular, phenomena that, people didn't understand what was going on and would have perhaps made up, supernatural explanations. So that's, of course, been the course of history. So let's read. This is what Brian Cox said when they began this discussion. He says, before we ask the first question, I want to make a statement. We are not here to debate the existence of ghosts because they don't exist. If we want some sort of pattern that carries information about our living cells to persist, then we must specify precisely what medium carries that pattern and how it interacts with the matter particles out of which our bodies are made. We must, in other words, invent an extension to the standard model of particle physics that has escaped detection at the Large Hadron Collider. That's almost inconceivable at the energy scales typical of the particle interactions in our bodies. So I thought that was an interesting statement. But let me throw something here into the mix. Quantum mechanics. It is like absolute mystery. It is like the mystery of watching miracles happen. And that's quantum mechanics, right?
I would actually go even in some ways a little deeper than that. I mean, I think what's baffling about quantum mechanics is that it kind of reveals just how few sort of Socratic questions it takes before you get to the level where the answer is, oh, I don't know. When you start to ask, okay, what is matter? Oh, well, matter's made of atoms. What are atoms made of? Oh, they're protons and neutrons. What are protons and neutrons made of? They're made of quarks. What are quarks? They're fundamental particles. Well, why? Like, where did they come from? What are they? They're fundamental particles.
Yes, sir.
I mean, they're particles. They're here. And they move through space. And it's, okay, and what is space? Space is the stuff that fundamental particles move through. When you get down to the level of, basically, why are there four forces of nature? Why is there matter and not antimatter? Why does the universe, exist or not exist? What happened before the Big Bang? Why is there a first moment of time? How could there be a first moment of time? When you get to those levels of questions, which are kind of like questions that kids ask,
yeah,
you get to that level of questioning, and the answer to everything is, that's just the way it is. We don't know any deeper. It is what it is. We don't know. Maybe there's a deeper answer, but we haven't found it yet. So I feel like, the mysteries of quantum physics in some ways are symptoms of the sort of deeper level of, that life is a deep, deep mystery. And as long as you stay a couple levels above that and you can, you know, you can build an iPhone, and you can build a rocket, and you can build a house, and you can live your life, and you have kids, and you watch movies, and you make podcasts, and you do all these nice things. But as soon as you start to really ask the fundamental questions, you get into these, like, holy shit, we don't know what we're talking about kind of moments.
Well, quantum physics is really, isn't it? It's not just a mystery. It's like looking at ghosts. It's like looking, it's like seeing a ghost, you know, because it's impossible. Like what they're seeing, what they see is impossible, right?
Right.
And yet they're also working with it. Like we have quantum computers. We can use it. You know, we can actually use it. I don't know. I just always find that to be, you know, so interestingly connected to the mysterious world of paranormal stuff is this idea of quantum physics just being like, when we figure that out, obviously it will change everything. I mean, if that happens in our lifetime, it will be the next revolution. Who knows what it will mean, you know, when we understand it, but it certainly will change everything, probably, you know, as far as energy, you know, like what, how we can work with the material world, right?
Let me throw out, absolutely, and let me throw out a couple of related ideas. So by coincidence, right before I was talking to you, I was doing an interview with a researcher at Columbia University named Ilana April, and her field is studying dark matter. Uh-huh. Dark matter is this hypothetical stuff that fills the universe. We feel its gravity, but we don't see it. It outweighs all the visible matter by about 6 to 1. So it's like most of the matter in the universe is this unknown, unseen, hypothetical stuff that we only infer from feeling its gravitational pull. And she has spent the last 30 years of her career building a series of increasingly sensitive detectors to try to pick up this stuff. And by the fact that you've never seen the headline that they've discovered dark matter, you know the end of the story. She spent 30 years looking for it, never finding it. She's probably going to spend the rest of her life, you know, until she dies looking for it. And I don't have great confidence she's ever going to find it. But, you know, whatever it is, it, again, it's something that is outside the realm of the particles that we know. It may be completely outside the realm of the fields we know. And back to your quote from Brian Cox, yeah, there's a lot that we don't know about just you know, that standard model of particle physics that he's talking about. Everyone knows is an incomplete model. It's that it doesn't explain what dark matter is. It doesn't explain this whole other thing that's even less understood called dark energy that seems to have that seems to permeate the universe. There's a whole dark universe which is vastly bigger, vastly more massive, vastly it actually controls the destiny of the universe. And we have no idea what it is. So, you know, we were watching The Shining and there are these, you know, this sense of an invisible and an unknown world. Well, there is an invisible and an unknown world out there. And, you know, even with all these, you know, very, very smart and very dedicated people trying to make sense of it, we're really barely chipping away at it.
Yeah. And final question, how is it possible that a 6-foot-tall champagne glass filled with a jacuzzi and with two young lovers bathing in it does not collapse? I mean, it's a tiny stem, and then you have this giant bowl of human life that's in love, generally, and it just doesn't seem physically possible.
I'll go further. Suppose that sexy couple in the champagne glass wanted to have sex. How are they going to do that in the champagne glass?
And how is it not painful on your back, the edge of the thing?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it sounds like one of those things that really like it reads better than it plays.
Yes, right. Well, Corey Powell, thank you so much for being on.
Oh,
this,
thank you.
And happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th of July to you as well. Enjoy your freedom for as long as it lasts.
I'm trying. And happy birthday to your beautiful daughter.
Thank you so much.
Don't let her hear this episode.
I will try not to chop her up into little pieces with an axe.
Okay. Thank you so much to Corey Powell, science writer, science authority. You'll see his name on magazine articles, book covers, and yes, occasionally his face on TV. And it was an amazing pleasure to have him on. and I hope he comes back. Please do join the Shining 237 on Facebook or on Twitter. Even if you don't use them, just join. I could use the numbers. And of course, please subscribe on iTunes. If you like the show, please leave a good review, because that does enormous good for this relatively small, modest, little-known podcast. Thank you so much if you do that. And so next week, our guest will be Adam Howard, who is a cinephile and associate producer on Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. He will be a guest on episode number 35, in which we will hear Mr. Grady talking about his daughters. We'll hear about the twins again. And we will hear Mr. Grady rolling his R much better than I can possibly do when he says, "I corrected them."
Your eyes held a message tender.